This is Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the American Counseling Association's 2009 podcast series. Today we are speaking with Roseanne Scheppler, an LPC and a Jungian analyst. Roseanne Scheppler is a Jungian analyst currently on the faculty of the C.G. Jung Institute of New York. She's also in private practice in Vienna, Virginia. Today we are going to be speaking with Roseanne about Jungian analysis, dreams, and transference and countertransference. Welcome, Roseanne Scheppler.
Thank you.
I'm really happy that you're here today with us because it's slightly different having an LPC also be a Jungian analyst, and I'm always interested in looking at all aspects of the profession. So thank you for being here and welcome.
Well, thanks for having me, really.
Good, good. The first question that comes to mind is, what is the difference between counseling or therapy and Jungian analysis?
Well, there's a lot of difference, and yet there's a lot of similarity, which is what I like about the whole thing here. And that's that, you know, in psychotherapy, I think we generally sort of look at what the crisis is, what the problem is, mm-hmm. you know, somebody's thinking, mm-hmm. you know, what's going on with them in their life, and is there, you're looking neurologically, you're looking for depression, you're looking, you do this, all sorts of things that one looks for. And not that I don't do that, I do that as well, but I think with Jungian analysis, we actually sort of look more for like what we call complexes. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, Carl Jung almost called his theory complex theory. Hmm. So, and where Freud would say the royal road to the unconscious is the dream, Carl Jung would say the royal road to the unconscious is the complex. Hmm. And so when he started out, early in his career, he was working on the word association test, mm-hmm. and he found that as, you know, if you ever, you can imagine what it is, you say a word, somebody gives you an automatic response, and mm-hmm. he actually would time the response and see if there were any differences in the quality of the response or if it was a different word or if they forgot, and he found that in doing this that there would be some words that somebody would have a hesitation over. And it was what he realized was that in some way the unconscious was interfering, and due to some sort of an emotional response to the word, and he came up with the idea that this was a complex and it has a feeling tone to it, meaning that there's an emotional response to something that takes you back to a prior time that interferes. And so from there, actually one of his pupils administered the word association experiment on 24 families mm-hmm. and noted that there were similar patterns in the responses between the children and the parents, indicating that even family members had similar complexes. Mm-hmm. So, and children tended to score nearer to and have emotional responses very similar to their mother more than their father.
Hmm. So, what do you think that's about? Why mother more than father?
Well, I think back then, and mm-hmm. I can speak for maybe, I wasn't there, but I'm mm-hmm. assuming that, you know, most of the time the children were, the mothers were home. The mm-hmm. children were more with the mothers than mm-hmm. the fathers. And not that fathers didn't have an impact, but I think early on, mm-hmm. you know, I think the influence was very much with the mother.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, these intense affective states, you know, were recreated in the children. And actually, I've noticed this in some parents with phobias, that children will develop the same phobias.
Right.
You know, so you can see how these sort of complexes, so to speak, mm-hmm. get carried down from generation to generation. Mm-hmm. Of course, when that, you know, child reaches adolescence, there's usually a shift away from the spell of the family, and he goes out into the world and tries to adapt. Mm-hmm. But in addition to complexes, there's another thing I think that's very important that Carl Jung contributed, and he talked about typology. Mm-hmm. And here we talk about temperament and introversion and extroversion, mm-hmm. Thinking and feeling, sensation and intuition. And then mm-hmm. Myers-Briggs came up along with judging and perceiving.
And, you know, I understand, now correct me if I'm wrong, Roseanne, but I understand that that Myers-Briggs came up with the personality type indicator from Jung's 1921 book called Psychological Types. Is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, he did.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, we think of Myers-Briggs personality indicator as something relatively modern, but it's interesting that its underpinnings are in 1921.
You know, there are lots of instances where when we look at Jung's work that mm-hmm. we'll say, my gosh, he was really ahead of his time, or mm-hmm. actually, really, he's just relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
this is one of those things where it's still very relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, in addition to parents having their complexes mm-hmm. for children to deal with, children come in with their own hardwiring in terms of basic, you know, extroversion and introversion, and then they learn how to be in the world in a certain way, which may be they're more of a thinking type or they're mm-hmm. more of a feeling type. Mm-hmm. And by the way, a feeling type is not somebody who is emotional, although emotions is part of it. A feeling type is somebody who is comfortable in the world by making decisions based on whether it feels important or right or mm-hmm. good versus just the facts and the logic.
Hmm.
So how people and how children perceive their parents is another thing that goes along with the nurture part of how they experience the world and how they end up with complexes. And so hmm. you think, okay, so what does this mean? So here's what this means. So as we are growing up, how does one develop a complex? As one is growing up, we belong to a tribe, which is mm-hmm. wonderful. You know, your tribe can be your family, it can be your community, it can be where you work, it can be a lot of different things, you know. So
it could be a foster or adoptive family as well?
Exactly.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. A tribe is just a place where you belong, and when you're in a tribe, the good part of the tribe is that the tribe, everybody is about the same, you know, they have the same values, they share the same feelings and thoughts, and they do things in certain ways, and they love you, and they raise you, and that's the great thing about the tribe. Here's the bad thing about the tribe. So, as you're growing up, you have to adapt to the tribe, which
yeah.
means that you have to repress parts of yourself. You know, survival mm-hmm. occurs because you have to dissociate or suppress your true feelings or expression mm-hmm. of your feelings or parts of oneself, either due to developmental nodal points, or maybe trauma, or maybe transitions.
Mm-hmm.
And so all these thoughts and feelings, images and emotions get split off and put into the personal unconscious.
Mm.
So to speak your truth sometimes can result in quite a moral dilemma because we need to belong to a tribe when we're growing up. We can't say, well, I don't like what you're doing. I'm packing my suitcase. I'll be back when I'm 21.
Right.
We have to kind of get through it, and we all do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good thing on one hand because we don't go around biting people when we're 20 years old when we don't get our way.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, what parts of ourselves did we lose? And those parts that we lose in order to adapt, mm-hmm. you know, go into what Jung would call our shadow, and they become complexes because they're little buttons that get pushed.
Mm-hmm.
So once the child matures into adulthood, there are these remnants that need to be worked on.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
result the complex.
And sometimes, isn't it also true that sometimes you talked about trauma and dissociative states? Isn't it also true that somebody might be completely unable to access the trauma or be blocked in some way because of some trauma? And that would that be part of the complex or part of the shadow?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a good definition of it. It's something that we don't remember goes into mm-hmm. the personal unconscious, which means we're unaware of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, for instance, if this is just like a little minor thing,
mm-hmm.
let's just say that a child grows up and the father is never home, okay,
mm-hmm.
and that's a loss to the child. Okay, the father's never
right.
there. And so whatever that's about, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the child grows up and finds that marry somebody that didn't seem this way but ended up never being home.
Mm-hmm.
So that early childhood trauma of loss,
mm-hmm.
you know, gets recapitulated then again in adulthood. And generally speaking, not because we want to recapitulate it, but we recapitulate it because we want it to get to stop it so we can get better.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. you know.
Or do we also just want to understand it? So do we kind of seek scenarios where we can have a better understanding of it?
Well, we seek scenarios so that we can become conscious, I think.
Mm, okay, good point.
You know, so to become conscious of it means that we then can own the feelings that got, or images, thoughts that got, you know, cut off as
mm-hmm.
we were developing that we could have accessed and used. Like maybe aggression could be one of them. Using aggression in our service, but we can't be aggressive. So maybe in some ways if we become aware of the incident and see the pattern of how we've not been able to fend for ourselves, that we can then make a choice to be able to fend for ourselves in a way that uses aggression in a very responsible way versus sideways.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that...
Describe how somebody might do it sideways.
Well, you know, whenever somebody gets in a complex, mm-hmm. you know, about something, it's like when your buttons get pushed.
Mm.
And actually, I sort of find that more or less, it's in the more intimate and closer relationships that these buttons are liable to be pressed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those are usually
right.
with your significant other.
Sure.
Because you find somebody who's going to match a lot of your own wounds, and then you mm-hmm. get to spend a lot of time with that person, and we have all these expectations about what this person's supposed to be to us or mean to us. And so we have to make it conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're in a complex, you kind of don't really know what you think. You're really justified in how you're thinking and feeling. It's like you put on a pair of blue glasses and you're seeing that person only through blue glasses, and the person's going, wait a minute, you've got your blue glasses on. I'm just not this horrible thing you think I am.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you don't see it. And then
that's
you,
a good image. I like that image.
Yeah. So, you know, basically it's very difficult for us to see that we're in a complex, but it has such an emotional charge to it. That's how you know it's a complex. When there's an overreaction to something, it's because it's patterned. It's like something that, you know, you do sort of reflexively in response to something. It's like you're touchy about something because of how you were raised, those transition points or those traumas. And so you come out sideways at somebody and you shout at them or you scream at them. And that's what I mean by coming out sideways versus saying, wow, you know, I get really upset and hurt by this kind of behavior, and I don't know how to change what you're doing, and I want to hear you. You know, there's some adult way to do it or maybe a responsible way to do it, but when you're in a complex, it's really hard to be able to do it. It's just like the unconscious takes over.
So you might have, like, for example, a reaction to something that just doesn't seem to fit with what has gone on.
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah.
Right. And so in Jungian psychology, you know, Jung would talk about the self-regulation of the psyche, and he would say for every action there's an opposite and equal reaction, meaning that when you have these reactions, you know, there's the other part of the psyche that wants to help you understand this, and he calls that the self-regulation of the psyche, which means that the psyche has a purposeful or teleological bent that it's supposed to help us to create balance so we can kind of see the other side, because we end up being sort of one-sided a lot of times. You know, you go through life and you have these ways of thinking about something, but sometimes you need to be able to think about the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're too one-sided or in a complex, your unconscious is going to try to help you compensate via dreams, which will lead us into, I'm sure, our the second question that
right.
we're going to probably talk about.
Right.
So, you know, it's not just that you're in a complex, but how is it that the psyche tries to help you see what you can't see, you know, from an ego point of view?
Okay, I do want to talk about dreams in a few minutes, but I did a little reading on a Jungian analysis over the weekend, and one thing, there are actually three words that came up a lot, and I was going to ask you if you could give us some kind of brief understanding of these three words. Archetype, anima, and animus. Those three came up, and they're not typically words that we use in a counseling context. So give us a little understanding of what those three terms are.
Okay, so an archetype, if you look at the unconscious, there's the top layer would be your personal unconscious.
Right?
That's all the stuff from your experience that gets repressed and it's put into the unconscious. And then there's what he would call the collective unconscious. And the collective unconscious sort of has as part of it archetypes. And archetypes, if you think of them as innate patterns of behavior that are, you know, that are actually instinctive, actually, I almost have a spiritual side to them. It's like a continuum between, like, infrared and ultraviolet. You can't know them in and of themselves when they're in the unconscious. Whatever's in the unconscious is unconscious. But if you look at an archetype, it's a dynamic that takes shape. It's like a – think of a crystalline structure, and within the crystalline structure, like a honeycomb. Mm-hmm. Crystalline structure is the archetypal dynamic. The honeycomb part of it gets filled in by our personal experience. So therefore, the mother archetype, mm-hmm. right, which has to do with mothering,
mm-hmm.
now gets filled in by our personal experience of mother. But there is a certain innate pattern of behavior that one sees with when one mothers. And it could be good mother and it could be bad mother.
I noticed, by the way, I want to tell our listeners that you gave a workshop recently at the Jung Institute in New York City on Mother Dearest, Mommy Dearest. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Well, that sounded fascinating. We'll have to ask you back and just talk about that one day because that just sounds very interesting. But so you're talking about the mother archetype. Okay. Now, myself, I have a mother. I am a mother. What would I naturally be gravitating towards as I thought about the mother archetype for myself? Towards my mother or towards my mothering? Or do you know what I'm saying?
Right. I think mm-hmm. I think it's actually both.
Okay.
You know, in some ways, you know, you have an experience of mother from your own childhood, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But when you become a mother, there's another innate sort of sense of how you will be when you're a mother.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Partly, mostly, it's like it's just natural. That's what I mean by innate and instinctive. It's just sort of a natural response and pattern of behavior of mothering. But also, you have since you've had a mother, mm-hmm. you know, you have your own personal experience of having had a mother, which also somewhat influences how you will be a mother,
mm-hmm.
right? And so you can look at, okay, for instance, archetypal images will come up mm-hmm. around things like, you'll see them in all cultures. That's what makes them archetypal is that you will see every culture will have these same archetypes. Mother is one, healer is one. Which is one, you know, you'll see the God is another. You will see all these same things from one culture to the other. That's why I sort of assume that they are archetypal.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't like
mm-hmm.
a huge number of them, but mm-hmm. there are many of them.
There are many.
Each one will have a valence. I mean, you can have a father, of course, is
mm-hmm.
one, and
mm-hmm.
you can have a good father, and you can have a bad father. You can have mm-hmm. a good mother. You can have a bad mother. These are all dynamics and experiences that are related throughout the entire world. People can relate
mm-hmm.
to them.
So archetype is, you know, is another thing we could spend a whole session on because it sounds really interesting to learn about the archetypes.
Right, and you know, the other thing is, you know, you spend when you wonder what does one do when one goes to the Jung Institute? What do you
mm-hmm.
study? And we spend
yeah.
a lot of time studying. We study fairy tales.
Mm-hmm.
Those are dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
We study a lot of mythology, like Egyptian mm-hmm. mythology or Greek mythology or any sort of mythology, actually,
mm-hmm.
because what you're looking for is, and religion,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
what you're looking for is, you know, these dynamics that come across in all, you know, who wrote all these fairy tales? Well, people wrote these fairy tales.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they come from our psyche.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you're looking at patterns of behavior, like when I was doing my workshop in New York,
mm-hmm.
We were talking about a Japanese fairy tale about
mm-hmm.
a mirror and mother,
mm-hmm.
you know. So you look for these things that are sort of helpful ways of understanding dynamics. And I listen to it when people come, like I remember one time, well, this would get into countertransference and transference.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time a young woman walked into my office,
mm-hmm.
The first session, and as she sat down, this is the thought that flew into my head was, well, the princess is here. And in a good way, very naive young princess.
Sure.
I mean, you know, and I've never had that thought since, but it was
right.
like one of those things that comes up from the psyche, you know, related to what I've read and learned.
Okay, so that's the archetype, and that's interesting. Now, anima and animus also came up repeatedly as I was going over some literature. Can you tell us a little bit about anima and animus?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, an anima
mm-hmm.
or anima
mm-hmm.
is the word means soul, psyche,
mm-hmm.
is the feminine image for a man. It's the feminine for a man. It's the, and for an anonymous is the masculine for a woman.
Mm.
Now, people have said over time, like, why are these, you know, why can't a woman have an anima?
Mm-hmm.
Why can't a man have an animus? And in a way, if it's unconscious, I guess we do in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the way I look at it is that it's not that I don't have feminine parts to myself that I'm aware of. And actually, a lot of times when I look at a dream, and we talk about this later, and if there's a figure in the dream that's my sex, I look at it as more of a shadow part of myself. Now, because I'm not male, you know, and but I do have some, you know, we all have sort of a little bit of the other in us, right? I've got some testosterone. You think of those masculine things. But because I'm not male, I will project masculine out onto somebody that's male, generally speaking, or qualities that are male, and that's the animus. And it is the masculine in the woman, it's the feminine in the man that usually gets projected out on into the other end of the world.
Oh, great. Okay. So that's very interesting. I also wanted to ask you about dreams. Now, dreams are always fascinating to our clients. And sometimes I, you know, I haven't been in practice for a while, but when I was, I had people come in and they would, you know, they would, they had an idea about what their dream was about. And a lot of them were very, you know, it was very important and they wanted this validated. So dreams are always fascinating to our clients. How does a Jungian work with dreams?
Okay. Now, remember I said it a minute ago where we could be too one-sided in the world.
Yes.
That can create problems, especially when we get caught in complexes or there's something going on in our lives. So if the psyche is self-regulating, it tries to help by giving us a dream that might compensate our one-sided position to help us kind of get back more to center. So what we're looking for when we're working with dreams are many things, so I'm going to just sort of go down the list.
Okay, sure.
First of all,
sure.
For some people, some analysts that look at dreams, there are different ways to do it, and this is my way, but it's the one I like the best. So it's my one-sidedness, I guess, in this way. And I don't always do this because sometimes if there's a big emotional feel in the dream, I'll go right to that.
Oh, okay.
But when you listen to a dream, actually Greek plays were sort of fashioned after the structure of dreams because you have I'm going to look at the structure. First of all, you have a setting. And I think people kind of overlook the setting. The setting is really quite important because, you know, where it takes place is going to have something to do with if it's at your high school versus your childhood home versus your work setting versus your home versus out in the field. Those are all
versus a place you've never heard of or that you don't even know exists.
Right, which means
or
right.
you think you don't know. Yeah.
Or a new house. And sometimes people dream of new houses. I'm in this new house. I'm thinking, now their psyche is giving them a new place to be. You know, so you really want to look at the setting. Where does it take place? Is it familiar? And then what you're going to look at is what's the story, you know, what's going on in it, you know, what's the action in it.
Right.
And so you'll see what happens next. And then there's going to be some crisis or conflict that comes along, and you want to see what that is. And then there's a resolution or not a resolution. So that's kind of just the structure, but here's what you do.
Okay.
You want to look for a few things. One is associations, amplifications, explanations, emotions, bodily reactions, and actually you can do fantasy or imagination, active imagination with it. So when you're
working, bodily reactions might be what? Like if I put my hand to my chest, oh my gosh, you know that.
Right. Or I actually had somebody sitting on their hands one time.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yes, and so it's like, oh my gosh, what, you know, where do you know that from? And it's like, you know, people will have a way of, you know, if they're flushing while they're telling me a dream, like they're turning red or they start, you know, moving their foot a lot, how people become nervous.
Right.
You know, you look for those things as well. But when you write down in the association, it's not so much a free-floating association. You want to sort of find out the association to a particular thing. So if somebody is giving you an image in the dream, you know, and let's say they're on a bicycle, you want to say, well, you know, what are bicycles? And is this a bicycle you know? Or, you know, do you like riding a bike? You want to get as many associations, but you want to try to ground it some way to so that there's an emotional charge, like, oh, I love bikes. They're really fun, you know. And if the bike is broken, you want to say, well, it doesn't, you know, where in your real life are you not able to have fun anymore?
Oh, that's a good point. I see what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Want to try to ground it somehow in where is it going on in the person's current life.
In today, yeah.
In today, because I would say most of the time, the dream that you have is related to what's going on in your current life.
Mm.
The other thing is that maybe sometimes, and this is if you're sitting in the seat that I'm sitting in, you know, what comes to mind is a fairy tale or a myth. I remember one time a person, this was just a derivative from the session, was talking about how she feels like she's in a glass coffin. And who did I think of immediately but Snow White?
Mm-hmm.
I thought, okay, so this has to do with some other kind of a mother complex, right, because there's a stepmother who's trying to kill her.
Right, exactly.
Right. So I hold this.
The bad mother, the scary mother.
Very badly, mother. And so I don't necessarily say something at the time, but I may just hold it and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Or if sometimes, if I can't get, you know, an emotional response, I try things like, okay, so in the dream you have a pen. So what's a pen? Give me the, you know, objective explanation of what this pen is. And they may say a pen is a tool for writing. But then they may say, but it reminds me of the pen that my, you know, favorite aunt gave me as a graduation gift.
Mm-hmm.
See, now the pen takes on a new meaning.
Mm-hmm.
This is why it's kind of tricky when one gets these books that sort of say, if you dream this, this is what it means.
Right.
You know, because it really gets grounded more personally than that. And so it to me, they're sort of not necessarily true. And so then if you have, like, these, you know, particular body positions, it can be significant because they can arouse some, you know, some verbal or intellectual association. So, if in the dream somebody is like, this one person had this dream where they were sitting in a chair and there was a blade like hanging like a guillotine, and if they tried to save themselves and reach for the rope, the guillotine was going to fall and cut off their arm. So their arm was tied down. So I said, well, what would it be like to have your arm in that position, put your arm in that position? And the person was then able to elicit a memory going from to childhood.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it was very interesting.
Yeah.
So,
and today, and how it relates to today might be, you know, the person does not have use of their arm. What way do you feel that you are unable to move freely?
Well, yes, exactly. You know, where do you feel so confined that it's so dangerous? I mean, where is this anxiety coming? You know, there's a lot of ways.
Right.
I remember I had this is actually somebody I knew personally. Had a dream where she was in this town square, and there was this woman up against this wall, and you know, they had her hanging, her legs had been cut off. I mean, it was just this horrible, horrible scene, you know. So I just sort of looked at her and I said, so where do you know the feeling of your, you know, you're upside down, you're cut off at the knees? I mean, I just repeated the dream back personally. And, you know, she said, well, I wasn't telling anybody, but I'm recently separated from my husband, you know. And it's the feeling of the chaos. The chaos of that she was feeling was just, you know, coming. But she wasn't showing anybody, by the way.
It reminds me of, you know, a few years ago I went to an art therapy workshop, and I remember the art therapist showing us what children who were abused might be drawing, and showed us a lot of drawings. And a lot of these drawings, the children would draw a child without arms, and the child without arms could not do anything to protect themselves. And the child without feet could not get away from whoever it was who was trying to. And, you know, so it's kind of interesting. There's almost like a circle back to Jungian thought there in this this art therapy workshop that I had.
Well, right, and you could even say, and see what popped into my mind as you were talking was the handless maiden. You know, who didn't have any hands, whose hands were severed for the sake of the father. You know, and so see how
that's a fairy tale, or
yes, it's a fairy tale.
Okay,
and it's
boy, some of those fairy tales are scary, aren't they?
Well, yeah, they really are. They're not just all happy campers in those fairy tales, and I think that really speaks of dynamics that go on in the psyche and in between people. The other thing, going back to dreams, is working with fantasy and imagination. And a lot of times, if there is a figure in the dream and they don't know the person. A lot of times, by the way, I'll go back and say this first. If you're having a dream and there's your significant other or somebody close to you is in a dream, you know, you can look at it objectively as, you know, maybe it's related to this person in your life, but also it could be about this the qualities of that person within yourself at a subjective level. So you can always look at the dream on the objective level and the subjective level, which is, you know, you know, what part of you is this versus why do you think it's outside of you? But if you want to explore a dream situation, you can have the dreamer close their eyes and go back into the dream and allow the action to develop to see how the situation resolves, for instance, if there, it kind of stops at a certain point, because even though it's not the dream, it's still a product of the psyche. And that's the other thing, is you really want to be able to, you know, use the products of the psyche to work with somebody. And you can also have them speak to the person, like or I'll say, be that person. Close your eyes. I want you to be that person in the dream. And then I'll say, why are you here? Like a burglar. Why are you here? What are you trying to take? Why are you trying to take it from this person? And you know, of course, people always go, you know, they can't do this. It's like, just try it. Just try to relax.
It's like gestalt. When you try to have somebody talk to an empty chair, they say, what?
Exactly, exactly. And so you have to kind of get over that initial discomfort with it. And it's helpful because sometimes, you know, what the burglar is trying to do is to arouse you to become aware of something, not necessarily to take something. You know, so there are all sorts of different ways to do it. But probably the important thing in working with a dream is to let the person have the, like in Gestalt, like, oh, yeah, that really is what rings the bell for me. And you just keep, I keep what we call circumambulating. I'll just talk about the dream and we'll go back to it and, and you know, just sort of keep going around the associations. And, and if I don't feel like it's going this way, I'll go that way with it. I'll sort of think, well, you know, anything from childhood, you know, if they give me an age of somebody, I said they're with a child that's like 8 or 9, well, did something happen to you when you were 8 or 9? You know, tell me about when you were 8 or 9. What are 8 or 9 year olds to you? You know, and if it's a person they know, what is the, you know, describe that person's personality to me. What is that person like? And they'll say, well, in the dream or in real life? And I'll say, well, do me, you know, real life first, and let's talk about the dream. And let's say, for instance, that, you know, the, there's a dream going on where, you know, there's a Frankenstein coming through or something very scary, and they're just sort of standing there, you know, and not, you know, just sort of, it was a so-so association. And I go, well, what would happen in real life if something like that was happening? What would you be doing? And they say, oh, I'd be running, I'd be scared. And I said, well, where is it in real life you're not scared where you should be?
Ah, interesting.
You know, so there's always some way to kind of look at what's missing.
And it's interesting the way you're continually talking about bringing it back to the present, too, because I think a lot of people have what may be a mistaken idea about depth psychology and analytical psychology, which is that it's all about the past. It's all about when I was 3 years old and my mother.
Yeah, you know, it isn't, because what, really what you're looking at, I guess psychodynamic therapy, this is one, I like that because it sort of blends in with this, which is that you look at the past, not to stare at it, because staring at the past does nothing, except, you know, you go blank. But what you're really trying to do is find out where these nodal points are, where things happen, where the person had to stop being who they were supposed to become. I mean, one of the beautiful things I love about, you know, analytical psychology is it allows the person to become who the person's supposed to become. To me, it's not you're going to be perfect. It's not that you're going to be the best person. It's really not about adaptation. It's really about becoming you. How beautiful is that? And finding out about the parts of yourself that you don't know, and some of them are very filled with shame and fear and guilt.
Betrayal.
And, you know, so if you can look at those parts of yourself, because this is where these patterned responses and complexes get set up that get in your, that helped you survive as a child, but now are interfering in adulthood. So they're no longer adaptive. So you want to find out where those, because if you think about a complex, it takes the energy. We call this the gradient, which I never understood for a long time, and I get it now. If you have a complex, your energy is taken down to that spot where if you're in a certain situation, you're going to be looking at the world in a certain way. Once you've kind of been able to look at yourself and what part of you that is or whatever you're projecting or what you've lost, and you sort of can integrate it back in a conscious way, that energy that was used in a defensive way is now free.
Hmm.
Now you have more energy available to be in life in a different way.
Hmm. That's a really good point. You know, when you think of something that's you know, just continually stays compartmentalized or bundled up, and then you set that free, there's that space where it used to be that you can do other things with in your life now.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. You can take your blue glasses off a little bit.
You can take your blue glasses off. Okay, I want to ask you also, if you could please talk a little bit about transference and countertransference and what it really means within the Jungian paradigm.
Well, yeah, I'd love to.
I know that's not a small question.
I think in a way, if I think about transference and countertransference,
mm-hmm.
it's about the ability for both patient and analyst to have an opportunity to develop, for one. Actually, Jung wrote a whole essay on the psychology of the transference, and I think
mm-hmm.
it was volume 16.
Hmm.
And it's one of my favorite pieces of all time, and I've read it so many times, and each time I go back and read it, I've underlined something new. I don't think there's anything that isn't underlined at this point. But
aren't those books where we underlined and underlined and we wrote in the margins, and aren't those books valuable?
They really are. I love
this.
And actually, he uses alchemical images from the Rosarium
mm-hmm.
series.
Oh, interesting.
Because he spent the last 30 years of his life really working on alchemy,
mm-hmm.
And how that can be a metaphor for mm-hmm. Transformation. Because that's
for any of our listeners who don't know, can you tell them what is alchemy?
Alchemy, back way when, was about, and philosophy and science were mm-hmm. kind of intertwined, was how do you take a base substance and turn it into gold? And what are the processes that do that? So you take two substances and you try to turn it into gold, which is the transformational process.
Yes.
And so he used these series of pictures sort of depicting how, you know, in the analysis, you know, you go through the same thing as your patient, but you go through this process with your patient
mm-hmm.
where, you know, there's going to be a depression because now things are going to be coming to the forefront, and then you're going to do this work where it feels like there's nothing going on in it. But anyway, it's a beautiful piece, and I would recommend somebody read it. But I'll talk a little bit more personally, and that's that when I think that most people, when they do any sort of therapy, will notice that they're different with different people because
mm-hmm.
two different things, right? Two different people. Each couple is a different personality.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though you can be consistent throughout, you notice that most of the time you can be a little bit different with each person, and I find that as well. And like when that young woman walked in my office and sat down, and I thought, oh, the princess is here. That was my countertransference to her.
Hmm.
So I used it.
What was that about in terms of you?
Well, what it's about is it was my projection, first of all.
Okay.
I didn't even know this woman.
Right.
So where was this coming from? So it was my projection of something about the way she looked or acted or sat down. I mean, she
mm-hmm.
hadn't even said a word.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so.
Interesting.
And of course, I didn't say that to her, of course.
No.
Oh, you're the princess and you're here. But, you know, what I came to find out was that she pretty much had never grown up and left the kingdom, and she was still
mm-hmm.
kind of in the princess phase of her life. And there was
mm-hmm.
a lot of very horrible things that happened to this poor young woman, but
mm-hmm.
she never really grew up.
Oh,
and part of it was due to certain things that happened to her developmentally at a
mm-hmm.
very young age,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, like just right at 12, 10, somewhere in there,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know. But even more than that is I become aware of what goes on with me in the room and what goes
mm-hmm.
on with the client in the room. And some of mm-hmm. that is visual. But more than that, sometimes I'm sitting there going, boy, I'm feeling anxious. Why am I feeling anxious?
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't feeling anxious before the session.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm
mm-hmm.
going, so I'll use that and I'll say, are you feeling anxious right now?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I would say most of the time a person says yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
mm-hmm.
transference has to do with actually is you project onto somebody else,
mm-hmm.
you know, your thoughts and feelings about somebody you knew in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And countertransference is the response back to that. And it's mostly
mm-hmm.
unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of this is unconscious. But it can be a great tool. I mean, I'll be sitting there thinking, I'm bored out of my mind. I'm not even paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I'm
mm-hmm.
going, okay, so what's that about? Why am I doing this? And I start examining, you know, is it a pocket in me or what is it about this other person? Or mm-hmm. I don't feel like I'm in the room, and I just feel like the person's not even in the room with me, like they're not talking to
mm-hmm.
me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I start registering, you know, what goes on between the two of us so I can bring it up. Like, mm-hmm. you know, I'm just finding that you're not, I don't feel connected when you're talking to me. What's going on with you right now? Is there something going on?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they say no, then I go, okay, well, maybe it's me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't have to be right, but then mm-hmm. I'm still wondering why is it I'm having this response. And I can go back to my own work, and, mm-hmm. you know, if you're an analyst, you have to have gone through your own.
You have to have gone through analysis.
Yes.
Yes,
mm-hmm. yes, yes, which is
mm-hmm.
it's helpful to kind of look at your own complexes, right?
Sure, yeah,
so you're not
absolutely.
Acting them out on somebody else. So,
absolutely.
And so I'm always open to saying, well, maybe this is something that I don't know myself, but I'll use mm-hmm. it in whatever way I can to bring consciousness to the both of us.
Mm.
And whenever you go through a whole series of things, and most therapists know this as well, with somebody, it does change you because you are on a journey with somebody. And a lot of times you get to experience their journey in some way, either emotionally or intellectually or physically, or there's mm-hmm. some way in the container, all these different things that bind the two of you for you to do the work. And a lot of times I'll notice when a patient's very passive, I may feel very aggressive because I'm holding one end of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so a lot of times I sort of feel like I hold things for people. They project things onto me like I have the answer. I have no answer.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the beginning. I may not even have an answer at the end, but I try to hold
later
it.
Later on, yeah.
I mean, I try to hold the field so they have the answer.
Right.
You know,
right.
And
right.
so it is a very sort of unconscious but somewhat conscious process to be mm-hmm. have one foot in and one foot mm-hmm. out.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I know when I was seeing clients and I hear this from many others that there will be a certain client that comes in and for some reason you can't let go of their story as you go through your week. They just keep popping back into your head, you know, like, oh, either that was so sad or that was so awful or that was so beautiful, or there's something about that particular client which keeps staying with you. And whereas in counseling or therapy, you may not do much with that. In Jungian analysis, you would use it to understand your countertransference, correct?
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And
does that happen to you, by the way, that you're just there's one client that for some reason stays with you more than others? As after you've left the room?
More than others.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I'm trying to think of it. For instance, I know
mm-hmm.
that, you know, for those that have been really traumatized,
mm-hmm.
those are the ones that will kind of stay with me during the week.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
especially childhood traumas where there's been tremendous abuse.
Yes.
That always kind of shakes my psyche a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, to me it's a very sad thing.
Right. Right.
And so, you know, so those are the kinds of things that will stay with me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or conversely, if mm-hmm. somebody has a breakthrough and, you know, they're you know, doing really well and
mm-hmm.
something has happened that says that and
mm-hmm.
and they're in a much better space, then I might think about that a little bit longer too.
Mm-hmm.
And yet while there's always transference and countertransference,
mm-hmm.
the one thing that you talked about in the psychology of the transference very briefly was something called kinship libido, that regardless of, you know, our complexes and projections, that
mm-hmm.
at some level we do have kinship with people.
Mm-hmm.
And I like
mm-hmm.
that. It's not that
mm-hmm.
I ever want to be friends with my clients. That's
mm-hmm.
my role, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I can also feel a kinship with them.
Yes.
And that's quite beautiful to me that,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
because we are human, we have these similar experiences, even though we're different and they come up differently, but we have the capacity to understand our patients this
mm-hmm.
way,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, that what they go through, we can almost experience with them in
mm-hmm.
a way because of what goes on in the sessions.
Mm-hmm.
And and it is keeping that one foot out. I mean,
yes.
you know, from your practice, you can hear some pretty sad, sad things that have happened in somebody's life.
Yes.
And it's very emotionally, it can touch at anybody's heartstrings, but it's
yes.
the way to sit, have one foot out to say,
mm-hmm.
okay, so this is the trauma.
Mm-hmm.
How do we work with this trauma? How do
mm-hmm.
we, you know, understand what it's going to, how that impacted this person?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we just sit in silence and respect that that's happened to them?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just very, when you're in a space with somebody like that, I just sit back and just sort of honor how they've had to have their life.
It's very deep, and I remember I used to think, particularly when I worked with children, I would think that I had heard the worst, and then the next week I'd find out I hadn't. I hadn't heard the worst, that
right.
the shadow was very deep, the shadow or whatever we want to call it, the dark side. There are many terms for it, but I would think, I'm sure I have now heard the worst, and it would turn out that I hadn't.
Right, and then we have to sit and hold that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think, we honor, I use these words, but I really do mm-hmm. believe that we honor our patient's process by holding it and
yeah.
being with them.
Yes.
And it, because it is their process.
Yes.
And so.
And we honor their story.
Right.
Yes.
And I don't ever feel like it's my job to sort of say, here's what you should or shouldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
Actually,
mm-hmm.
I unless there's abuse going on, I don't say much of it. I don't
right.
say, here's what you should or shouldn't do.
Right.
But
right.
for the most part, it's having them, look at, what pattern is this for you? Or
mm-hmm.
this is how you would be with so-and-so when you're growing up, and this seems to be repetitive. Or,
mm-hmm.
What is the complex you're in? And by the way, mm-hmm. the other thing, going back to dreams, briefly,
mm-hmm.
whenever there's a person in a dream, I look at that as like a complex, a split-off part of myself in the dream. I mean,
mm-hmm.
this is how I would think about a complex as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you can imagine if your mother's in the dream, that, or your father's in the dream, or a sibling
mm-hmm.
is in a dream, that there'll be a closer tie to, your complexes.
Mm-hmm.
But going back to transference and counter-transference,
yeah.
It's really being aware. It's like if I had to really think about all the things I have that I think about when I'm talking to you, I probably wouldn't be able to
right.
say a word. I'd be thinking about all the things I should be doing. And by the way, back to dreams one more time. Whenever I hear a dream, I have to tell you, I'm like Carl Jung, who said, I have no idea what the dream's about. When I first hear it, I go, what am I going to do with this? I sometimes go, I have no idea what this
yes.
You just have
yeah.
to sit through the person and go through the
but
dream
the
with them.
But the dreamer can tell you. It's very interesting, I think of many dreams I have had personally and that people have told me about over the years. And the dreamer can tell you if you're able to break it down and offer them some clarifying questions.
Right.
Yeah.
Very, very much so. And,
mm-hmm.
When they ask all sorts of questions, but
mm-hmm.
it's just to have somebody sit with it and go through it with you and
mm-hmm.
and sort of parse it out, and they will tell you, and sometimes they'll say, well, it seems like this, this, and this,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
if they say, no, it's not that, and I go, well, then is it related to this? I go, yeah,
mm-hmm.
that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you just have to listen.
Yes, you just have to listen. That's right.
Right.
As we move towards the end of this this conversation, I wanted to ask you a few questions about yourself. So I assume that at one point you got a master's in counseling, as I did, and as most of the people who will be listening to this did. And then you went on from there, and you got an LPC. And how did you start moving in the direction of Jungian analysis? And tell us a little about how long it took and that kind of thing.
I became interested in Jungian psychology.
Mm-hmm.
Back before I even had a master's degree in counseling, I had a friend who was taking a psychology class and
mm-hmm.
just sort of mentioned Carl Jung, and
mm-hmm.
and I sort of read a little bit about him and thought,
mm-hmm.
oh, that's interesting. But then I was having children and raising them, and
sure.
so then I was back in school, and I was getting I had a master's in health education, but I went back
mm-hmm.
and got a master's in counseling
mm-hmm.
and said very much so that I was interested in Jungian psychology. But,
mm-hmm.
Then again, I would do my reading on my own, but
mm-hmm.
I got my master's. I was in Texas at the time. I came back to this area where
mm-hmm.
I'm originally from, and I finished up my LPC.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, you know what? I'm going to start analysis. Now, I didn't know,
mm-hmm.
If I was going to even go to the institute, but I just was interested enough that I
mm-hmm.
started my own analysis. And at that point, I think it was 150 hours of urine analysis. I think now it's less.
Mm-hmm.
And I applied to the C.G. Jung Institute in New York, where
mm-hmm.
I sent in an application and I had an interview. And at that time, the program was, I think, a minimum of 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think now you can do it in, I think you can do it in 4. And by the way, the state of New York has licensure for psychoanalysts.
Yeah.
I am a licensed psychoanalyst in the state of New York, where I got my certification.
Does anybody else have a certification for a licensed analyst, or is it just New York?
I think it's just New York at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really positive. I know it's the newest.
Yeah, I haven't heard about it anywhere else but New York. But
right. And so, which is great.
It sure is. Yeah.
Right. And so.
So you're a licensed professional counselor and a licensed psychoanalyst.
Correct. And so it was the first 4 years of the Institute are really mm-hmm. classes.
Mm-hmm.
And there's seminars.
How did you do it? You lived in Virginia, and you went. Did you go to New York? Just real often, or?
Yeah, I did. I went to New York. Mm-hmm. It was like a September through May, just mm-hmm. like college students, and it was every Monday, mm-hmm. and I come back Tuesday.
I see. Okay.
Day night.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the funny story of that is I had a friend in Oakton, Virginia, here who was a psychotherapist, and she said, "Oh, I have a sister-in-law who lives in New York City, and sometimes mm-hmm. she rents out a room." And so I called this woman sight unseen.
Mm-hmm.
And said, "Could I rent a room on Monday nights for the next 6 years?"
Oh, my gosh.
And we started talking, and she said, "Sure."
Isn't that wonderful? Isn't it wonderful how that worked out?
Yeah. Right. And you know what? I knew that was a pretty good sign, because when synchronistic things like that happen to me, mm-hmm. I go, "Oh, then this must have been meant to be."
Right. Exactly.
And so at the fourth year, you take your exam, and then mm-hmm. The last 2 years in, this is then, not now,
mm-hmm.
you would take, some courses into your thesis, but you're also doing supervision. You're doing case supervision in a group. You're doing private mm-hmm. supervision. You're doing low-fee supervision. I'm doing analysis and taking mm-hmm. coursework.
Mm-hmm.
And then having a practice and a family.
And then having a practice, too.
Right.
Wow.
So it was very well worth it. I think it has, it's become such a part of me now that I sometimes can't separate out psychotherapist from psychoanalyst. I think I'm just, mm-hmm. It's all pretty much.
It's all mixed together for you now.
In a beautiful way for me.
Yeah, sure. Well, is there anything else that you think our listeners would, that you want our listeners to know about Jungian analysis or about any of the things we've talked about today?
Wow. That's a big question.
It's a big question.
Well, I think I gave a very, very small thumbnail, impression of what,
mm-hmm.
Jungian analysis is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, there in the collected works, there are 20 volumes.
Right.
So you can imagine how, me speaking for less than an hour does this totally a disservice. But
no, I don't think at all. I don't believe that at all. I believe you opened a little window.
And perhaps so, and I'm glad to do that. And
yes.
And I think the thing I would like people to understand, if there's anything, is that mm-hmm. The dialogue with the unconscious or the psyche is mm-hmm. very relevant mm-hmm. to who we are. I mean, there is the ability to have transformation, mm-hmm. not just symptom relief, but mm-hmm. I'm talking about how something can be transformed mm-hmm. in a way that that you are different and you stay different. You don't go back to
yes.
where it was. I mean, like, you're able to actually
yes.
have a change in who you are. That's the beauty of depth work, is that
uh-huh.
there actually can be, change that is lasting and opens up new doors for you as far as your energy and available energy
right.
into the world. Mm-hmm. And it's that dialogue with the psyche
yes.
and being open to it that, to me, is just a hallmark of analytical psychology.
So I like that you were distinguishing between symptom relief and transformation.
Yes.
That's really wonderful. Because we can have symptom relief, and then we often wonder why we circle back to the symptom.
Exactly.
And sometimes it's because we haven't gone deep enough. And out of respect for those listeners who are into brief modalities of counseling, I would say that that there certainly is a time and place for a brief intervention and for extinguishing certain symptoms, but there's also a time and place for going into a more insight-oriented methodology. Do you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely, and you're right. There's no way I would ever disrespect mm-hmm. any of the other modalities that mm-hmm. you know that are not Jungian. Mm-hmm. I think that they all have their place and they're very valuable.
Mm-hmm.
This is just my way of doing it,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and it is a little bit more in depth.
Yeah. Yeah, I was reading an article recently, I'm trying to remember where it was, but I don't, is talking about a kind of resurgence of depth psychology. Have you thought there might be a resurgence of depth psychology?
Actually, no, I haven't. I know there aren't too many of us around,
mm-hmm.
and I know that it certainly had more of a place back a long time ago.
That, yes.
But I think it kind of comes, it sort of circles around.
Yes.
And, and so it circled around and it was sort of, and I'd like to see it circle back around again
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
I think it's still valuable. It's just we have to keep the myth living with today, So
mm-hmm.
it's like, and that's what I think is wonderful about Jungian or mm-hmm. analytical psychology is that it still is current. It still can be used
mm-hmm.
currently in our lifetime. And even if we're different than our ancestors were 100 years ago, these are still relevant, theories and concepts and, related to who we are today.
I have one more question for you. I think as a very young woman, I read Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, which I found fascinating. And it's all underlined, and I thought, boy, how did I know back then that this was so interesting because it was so long ago? And one of the things I remember about that is the parting of the ways between Freud and Jung.
Yes.
Can you say a little about that? Because I think a lot of people don't know much about that. Comment a bit on that?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
For contemporaries, but Freud was a lot older,
mm-hmm.
and Jung thought very highly of his ideas around the unconscious and
mm-hmm.
dreams. And so anyway, they started collaborating, and Jung was a great spokesman for, analysis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And but what really sort of, I think, transpired between the two of them over time was that there were differences. I think Carl Jung started having more of a sense of the collective unconscious. He didn't see it as all reductive back to the psychosexual stages of development or
mm-hmm.
even to Oedipus, which is what Freudian is another big concept in the Freudian field.
Mm-hmm.
So he was seeing something beyond what I think Freud saw.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, there was a time they were coming to do, I think, some lectures at Clark University here in
mm-hmm.
the States, and Jung had sort of presented a dream to Freud, and Freud looked at it, of course, very reductively, and it was actually back to the father complex, blah, blah, blah. But
mm-hmm.
Jung really saw in this one dream that he had shared with him that, his own associations to it actually made it a whole different thing. And so he realized that there were just these big gaps of understanding between the two of them and how they would look at things.
Mm-hmm.
And he also sort of thought he was caught in a father complex with Freud.
Hmm.
So eventually, Jung just sort of broke off, and then that's when he wrote this huge volume that's
mm-hmm.
called Symbols of Transformation. So actually, I think Volume 5 in the Collected Works, it's just a huge treatise based
mm-hmm.
on looking at somebody's fantasies through amplification of myth and legend, and not just simply reductively.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's where it really kind of made them split. I think that Jung had to stay true to who he thought he was becoming in his own thoughts and theories.
Mm-hmm. And wasn't Jung, this is going to be simplistic, but wasn't Jung much more open to the world of spirituality than Freud?
Well, yes, he was, but he would always mm-hmm. say that, he would say that he's an empiricist,
mm-hmm.
meaning that, he'd do something by looking at, like, the word association test.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that maybe the spiritual side of Jung could be sort of viewed in terms of, if you look at an archetype, mm-hmm. the dynamic of an archetype, let's say mother. You can go
mm-hmm.
from bad mother witch, right,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
to the other extreme of mother witch could be even considered the Virgin Mary,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's a very...
And the good witch, Glinda.
Or Glinda, right, something that's
uh-huh.
a very numinous
uh-huh.
feeling, that's very
uh-huh.
spiritual. And so in that sense, yes, I think that one of the main concepts of Jungian psychology is the self with a capital S. mm-hmm. which is the archetype of transformation.
And this,
these are my words now, that if you had, as things come up into consciousness, you have images of them, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's when they split into opposites, because in the unconscious, mm-hmm. there is no good or bad. In the unconscious, it's just one dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
As it splits into awareness, mm-hmm. it's either the bad mother or the good mother.
Mm-hmm.
And as the archetype of the self comes into consciousness,
mm-hmm.
you know, it comes out as the image of God.
Oh, interesting.
It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that was part of how Jung viewed things. So, mm-hmm. so I don't know whether it's spiritual, but to me it is in a way, but it's not like a religion. It's just sort of how he would hold human dynamics, because spirituality is a part of humanness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because all cultures have religion.
Right.
Therefore, it's archetypal.
Well, this has been fascinating, Roseanne Shepler. It's quite a departure from what we have normally talked about on these podcasts. But, you know, one of the things I was reading in preparation for this conversation with you today talked about the three founding fathers of analytical psychology being Jung, Freud, and Alfred Adler. And Alfred Adler is somebody who is very revered in the counseling profession. So
very much so.
So that's kind of my circle closing of bringing it back to the American Counseling Association. I want to thank you so much, Roseanne Shepler, for joining us today to discuss Jungian analysis.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. To view links of this program or to write to the presenter or the host, go to www.counseling.org and click on the podcast page. This is Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the ACA 2009 podcast series, signing off.